The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
Remember this. When you're the greatest fighter in the world today, they got a name for you. They don't call you a great fighter. They call you Chael Sonnen. Beat me if you can.
And after tonight, none of you in this ring will ever... again!
You're talking to the Rolex wearing, diamond ring wearing, kid stealing, woo, wheeling, dealing, limousine wreck, jet flying, son of a gun, and I'm having a hard time holding these alligators down. Woo!
I'm gonna drink a Coors Light. That's a Coors Light because Bud Light won't pay me nothing.
And I have my cold beer. You have your cold beer? If not, you are fucking jabroni.
Wash it down with one beer, two beers, three beers, a shot of whiskey.
Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
The following announcement has been paid for by the New World Order.
All right, welcome to the Filthy FRB show for, I forgot the date. It's Wednesday night, though. But we have Larry Pepe with us here. And when I heard the news last night about Anderson Silva flunking a drug test, I thought of one guy who would know more about this than anybody in the media, in the MMA media. And that's Larry Pepe. He's got a background from the bodybuilding industry. He's had a podcast on Pro MMA Radio about MMA for 7 or 8 years. So I'd like to welcome Larry Pepe to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you, Larry. You know, like I said, you know, whenever these things come up, you're the guy. So tell us first, what are these substances that Anderson tested positive for? And in layman terms, what does it do for you?
Right. Well, he tested positive for two different substances. Let me take them one at a time, and let me, for your listeners, kind of separate out under the WADA code, which is the drug code that the athletes are governed by. There's a section on what's called exogenous agents and another section on what's called endogenous. And exogenous means that it doesn't exist in the body naturally. And endogenous means, for example, testosterone, it exists in the body, but you're not allowed to take a synthetic form of it and put it into the body. So the first substance that he failed for is an exogenous agent called masterone. And that's the trade name. It's more commonly referred to in its chemical name of drostanolone. And it was actually developed over 40 years ago to combat advanced breast cancer in postmenopausal women. What makes it very unique is that a lot of times when you get steroids that have a pronounced effect on strength, those steroids come along with that. The negative, the con to that, is that you're generally going to get water retention. You're going to get weight gain. And I would go back, for example, to when Rampage Jackson missed weight in Japan, and then it later came out that he was on testosterone. And it was like, I think, the first time in his career in 35 fights at that point that he had missed weight. And when it came out that he was on testosterone, it became more understandable, because when you take drugs that have that high strength impact and additional muscle mass, although this drug is not known as much for muscle mass, with it usually comes water gain. A lot of times you hear about gynecomastia, which is often referred to as bitch tits. The reason that masterone is so popular in athletes who have to make a weight is because it increases strength. It tends to cut some body fat, And it's often mistaken for a diuretic because you don't hold water. So it's kind of like you're getting the benefit of that additional strength that you're looking for. But you're not ballooning up 10, 12, 15 pounds that's going to make your weight cut miserable. And that might explain why, at least by my quick research, Anderson is the 11th MMA fighter who's tested positive for finasteride. And perhaps even more interestingly, he's the third fighter in the last 7 months from Black House or a Black House affiliate that has tested positive for finasteride. So the finasteride makes sense from a fighter perspective because you're going to get the benefits you're looking for and you're not going to deal as much with the cons of taking a drug that really enhances strength. And it's also good because you're cutting a little extra fat. When you move on to the second drug, that is an endogenous drug. And let me just, before leaving the finasteride, let's just couch this conversation that Anderson's second sample has not come back yet. There are Anderson fans, understandably, who are hoping against hope that that second sample is going to be clean. I think the odds of the second sample being clean are unbelievably low for the simple reason that the substance in his body doesn't exist in your body unless you put it in there because it's exogenous, and that's the finasteride. The second drug that he tested for is an endogenous agent, which means that it naturally occurs in the body, but you're taking an outside synthetic source, which you're not allowed to do. Unlike the finasteride, the second agent is a high androgen drug. And that means you're going to get strength, you're going to get muscle mass, but you're also going to get those negative effects we talked about, like the excess weight, the water retention, the bitch tits potentially if you were on it for a long time. And that kind of makes the finasteride as part of the stack more understandable because finasteride has a very strong reputation of limiting those negative effects in an androgenic drug, which the second one was, that they categorized as androstain, which is a broad category. If you look at WADA, there's about a whole bunch of different metabolite configurations of androstain, androstenediol, and all those. Under the broad category, they're all high androgen drugs, and it makes sense that the two would be stacked together.
So, Larry, the finasteride, how would you go about getting that out of your system, and how long does it take to get out?
That's a great question. There's actually two forms of finasteride. One is called propionate, and the other is called enanthate. Propionate is very fast-acting, and as a result, it's actually injected. Some people use it every day. Other people use it every other day. But you're talking about a drug that is injected anywhere from 3 or 4 on the low side to 6 or 7 days a week. The reason it's injected so often is because it's a fast-acting steroid, and it's in and out more quickly. Now, that doesn't mean it's not detectable. Doesn't mean that when you take the injection on Wednesday after you took an injection on Monday that it's already out of your system. It's not. But generally, propionate is not going to be detectable somewhere in the 2 to 3 week range after the last dosage. Enanthate, on the other hand, is taken 1 or 2 times per week because it's a longer acting drug. It sticks around and it works in the system for a longer period of time, hence the less frequent injections. That can stay in your system. I've seen all sorts of estimates on enanthate. I've seen as high as 3 months. I've seen as low as 1 month. So I know the next question is going to be, well, is it possible he was on enanthate, took it a couple of months ago, not that that would be okay under the rules, but let's just say, took it a couple of months ago, and now it showed up in this test. It's possible, but it's highly unlikely for the simple reason that an overwhelming majority of the finasteride that's on the market is propionate. Enanthate is very rare and very hard to come by these days. So from everything I looked at, I saw estimates as high as 90% of what's on the market is propionate, which if Anderson were being advised by somebody, propionate would be what you would tell him to do because it's going to get out of his system faster and make him less likely to get popped on a test if that should come up. So propionate really makes sense logically, and it makes sense in terms of the realities of the availability of Masterone on the market.
So, Tom, do you have anything for Larry based on what he just said?
Not really. I mean, from my understanding, Anderson has been living in the U.S. For a while. And, you know, I think a lot of things that people discount when they look at this steroid situation is the differences in society's views on it across the different cultures. Here in the U.S., it's looked at a lot differently than it is looked at in other countries, including Brazil. I know that Mexico has steroids pretty regularly available to the public if they want to get it. So, you know, it's interesting to see that, you know, Anderson has kind of shifted, and he's been in the U.S. A lot of his training camp has been done here in Los Angeles area, which and Larry can, you know, chime in here. But it seems like that's more of a hotbed for like bodybuilding, you know, than other parts of the country. So perhaps, you know, him moving to that area and being involved in that scene has aided in that, getting him these steroids.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting point. I will say certainly there are countries very, very common in Europe. You mentioned Mexico, Tom, where you could walk in off the street into a pharmacy without a prescription and literally buy steroids right off the shelf like you can a vitamin here in the United States. That said, he knows he's governed by the WADA code. He knows that he's a tested athlete. He knows he's a combat sport athlete governed by a different set of rules. You bring up the commonality of the bodybuilding community in the Los Angeles area. It kind of makes me think of something else that I kind of alluded to a minute ago with the Black House connection. And it seems like it's in vogue these days to kind of take a guess on what percentage of fighters are using 80%, 90%. So I see everything. And that's fine. Anyone can hazard a guess. But at the end of the day, I think what we have to be mindful of is that it is a guess based on almost nothing, because when a fighter comes out, and Tom, you can speak to this as a fighter, if you come out and you say, hey, 70% of guys are using steroids, in my opinion, what you did is you just outed your gym, because those are the guys that you sweat and bleed with every day. Those are the guys that you're going to know exactly what they're doing. But I think when we assess these percentages, there's one thing that we kind of leave out of the equation. To believe that that percentage is that high, and don't get me wrong, I am as anti-drug in MMA as anybody. I think the last several years of screaming for random testing, screaming about the Nevada Athletic Commission and their incompetence, especially lately, you know, I think people know where I stand. But when you look at drug failures, we've had close to 60 drug failures in MMA. 50 of them are 155 and up. So when you get to those smaller weight classes, and it kind of makes sense, because if you're a guy who's 125 pounds, 135 pounds, I'm not saying no one in those classes is using, I'm sure there are. But the percentage, when you're that small and you could add 10 pounds and be completely incapable of making weight because you have too much muscle and now you have to move up a weight class and you're so small to begin with, the percentage of fighters overall, to believe it's 70 or 80, you'd have to believe basically 100% of welterweights and up are on. So I think that gym culture, and that's what made me think of it when you said it, it is certainly curious to me when you have Kevin Casey, Brian Ortega, and Anderson Silva, all affiliated with Black House, all testing positive in a seven-month period of time for the exact same substance. It goes back to my point that in gyms, it becomes more common that fighters use the same things or have similar attitudes because you're in the gym, you're talking, you're sharing. One guy, all of a sudden, Tom, you lock up with that guy, and all of a sudden, you can't take him down. And 3-4 weeks ago, you were ragdolling him. And now you go, wow, whatever he, I don't know what he's doing, but whatever he's doing is working. And then that's how it starts to proliferate. So I think that has a lot to do with the gym culture in MMA. And if you train at a gym where it starts to become more spoken about, more common, and now you're seeing guys advance and get better on it, that temptation lies there for everybody else.
And you know, Larry, you mentioned the other guys from Black House that have gotten pop for Masterone. There's also Feijão Cavalcante. I don't think he got pop for Masterone, but it was somewhat recent, and he's another guy in that circle. Do you remember offhand what he – was it Nandrolone?
I think it was Nandrolone. It was not Masterone, but he, I think he got popped in 12.
Okay, so
– so, again, like to your point, once it starts to get in a gym, it's not that uncommon where it will start to proliferate because people start to see advantages that, a guy gets when he's on it. And it's like anything else, man. If you hang out with a lot of people who drink a lot, you may drink more because in comparison, it's like, yeah, that's kind of cool. That's my peer group. Everything's fine. If you hang out with a bunch of people who don't touch liquor, you may start to take a different attitude or feel differently about drinking a lot. So if you're around people who use and you're around people using a specific substance, that's the kind of thing that's interesting to me on the Masterone side, you can see where it starts to spread out to other fighters.
So if we want to just summarize what Masterone does, it doesn't hold water, but it allows you to cut down in weight, but to continue to put on muscle mass, increase strength. Is that kind of a decent thing?
Pretty close. It's not a big body fat eliminator. It will help a little bit. Definitely doesn't hold water. Definitely increases strength. That's the big thing. That's why you'll see a lot of athletes, bodybuilders especially, close to a competition. Masterone will be something that comes in maybe in those last 4, 6, 8 weeks. Because they're already getting lean. It's going to help take off that last little bit. They're not going to hold fluid, which is disastrous for a bodybuilder coming into a competition. But they're going to hold on and increase their strength, which allows them to maintain their muscle mass as they're continuing to get rid of that last bit of body fat. And that's why it's such a popular drug in the what I'll call weight division communities, because you're going to get the benefit of the added strength without the negative of the added water retention and water weight that now makes your weight cut a lot more hellacious than it was in the first place.
So do you think Anderson just got caught for these two substances, or is there another part of the stack that might have went under the radar?
You know, my guess is that it's these two, simply because if they caught these two, I don't have much of a reason to think that they wouldn't have caught something else. The interesting thing to me, and I've had people reach out on Twitter and I've had some emails today, that, you know, could it have been because he was recovering from injury? The answer for me in that regard is an emphatic no. These drugs are, if you told me that he popped for HGH, I could at least make an argument for him. Not that I would want to do that. Yeah, nothing against Anderson Silva. I don't like drug use in MMA. I can make an argument for him. He came off this horrific injury. He's almost 40 years old. He's rehabbing a shin that looked like a piece of rope when he got taken out of the cage. And HGH is a very powerful healing and recuperative agent. That is the most dominant property that HGH has. These are not big-time healing agents. Masterone, for my money, is not a healing agent at all. It's a strength agent more than anything else. And it's more of a cutting agent than any type of recuperative property.
Now,
the second – go ahead, Larry.
No, I was going to
– The second drug has some healing properties, but again, it's not – you don't say, wow, I really need to heal because – I had an injury. I really need to heal because I had surgery. I want to expedite the process. Neither one of these drugs comes in your head. These are not. And even if you wanted to make the argument of a healing agent. This was 13 months after the injury took place. Tell me he did that the first 3 months, the first 4 months. Again, not with these substances, but let's assume it was HGH. Okay, he's trying to expedite the healing and expedite the formation of the bone and healing around the rod. All right, at least you have an argument. I don't think you have any argument in this case with these two drugs.
You know, question for Tom, because you know, you're actively training. You're training for your comeback this summer. Larry was talking about, you know, you're in the room with the guys and you take on a lot of their personality and a lot of their habits. And I know you're a guy who's never messed around with performance enhancing drugs. Throughout your career as a fighter, has it been difficult for you to say, I'm not going to participate in consuming those types of substances when you openly see guys use or openly hear them talking about using?
For me personally, no, it's not very hard because I don't make enough money to buy this stuff. I mean, I'll be quite honest. If I was getting millions of dollars per fight and the steroids were a difference between me making $1 million or $2 million, you know, my mindset might be a little bit different. But to me personally, you know, in this situation, it's not very hard. I haven't run into very many people that have, you know, no one's ever actually offered me anything. People will say like, hey, you know, after I had a knee surgery, they would say, hey, you know, I could get you some HGH, but nobody was really pushing it. And for me personally, it's just not something that I'm interested in doing at all. I think it's disrespectful, not only to yourself, but more so to your opponent. And that's the biggest issue that I have with it. You mentioned as well that you kind of take the characteristics of people in the gym. And since I've been here in Vegas training with Vinny Magalhaes, I've been late to everything. I've been late to every single thing that I'm supposed to do. So I can see how people get dragged into the situation where, you know, one guy's doing steroids and, you know, he's in the gym and he's starting to improve. So you feel that you have to do the same. But, you know, I think if you really are a martial artist at heart and you separate yourself from the notion of earning more money, then it's something that's very easy to stay away from.
So Larry's touched upon the science of things, and but let's talk about now what the commission, their culpability in all of this, because I find it very convenient that this test that Anderson Silva submitted to was on January 9th, and it got to the lab in Salt Lake City on January 12th or 13th. I believe it's the 12th because they 12th. Mailed the 12th. Okay, regular yep. mail. And we didn't find out about this until February 3rd. And they said this is completely – it usually doesn't happen. Now, was it just a mistake or was it because we had a $5 million gate and thousands of people coming from Brazil to Las Vegas to see Anderson?
Is that to me, Brian?
Yeah, for you, Larry.
Yeah, listen, I'm not buying the mistake angle. I'm sorry. I mean, Dr. Johnny Benjamin was on Twitter last night saying that this is a test that takes minutes to do, not days. So let's give him the benefit of the doubt. It gets there on the 12th. Let's say it takes a week to get the result. That's the 19th. That's still 12 days before the fight, and it's impossible for me to believe, and this is just my opinion, that you have a multi-million dollar fight taking place, Anderson Silva, you do an out-of-competition test, which is absolutely appropriate, and you don't expedite it to make sure that, because according to Bennett, the Nevada State Athletic Commission executive director, he didn't expedite the test. Then he says, which is mind-blowing to me, because you would think, listen, if I place an order on friggin' Amazon.com and it doesn't show up on time, I usually send an email or check or make a phone call to see where it is or why it's delayed, okay?
Right.
You're telling me you sent in an out-of-competition test for both guys. You don't have it. It's not here. And it's well beyond when it should be here. Nobody picks up a telephone. Nobody says, Jesus Christ, We have a $5 million fight happening. We have all these people coming, and we don't know if the participants are clean. And we sent the test in on the 9th, and his explanation is that they were really busy. Well, if you're too busy to call and get the drug test results on a main event fight of a fight with a huge gate, I would argue that you wanted to be too busy, because we all know that one of the main sources of income for the Athletic Commission is these fights taking place. And that is the problem with the Athletic Commission doing the testing. If you give a crap about MMA and its credibility, and, oh yeah, the health and safety of the fighters, I think that's their job, the commission, and the second thing is fairness of competition. You failed miserably on both fronts. So the only way you're ever going to get some credibility back, if you're the UFC, is to stop the sham that you're not going to hire a third-party company and do drug testing. They were going to do it because they finally got enough heat. They were interviewing companies. Everybody was going to be random tested all year, blah, blah, blah. And then if you notice, it went by like they announced an undercard fight on Fight Pass. Dana came out the week of the John Jones fight and said, yeah, we're not going to do that anymore. We're just going to give more money to the commissions. Okay, so wait, you're going to give more money to the same group that ran a cocaine test on John Jones when it's not banned at the time that they tested him for it, and now the same group that ran an out-of-competition test on both of your fighters, both of them failed. One of them was on two PEDs, if those results are confirmed, but they didn't get them back in time or follow up, and they let him get in the cage. Come on. It's a farce. It's just a farce.
What's your take, Tom?
Agreed.
Awesome.
I think it's pretty tough to sit here and look back and say that, you know, everything happened as it should have. And the results, you know, it just takes that long for the results to come in. That's not the case. Look, I could drive to Salt Lake City in 5 hours from Las Vegas. Or, you know, if the test is in California, I'm not sure where the test was done. But there's a WADA lab in Los Angeles.
Yeah, at UCLA.
Yep. Yeah, so to say that you couldn't get there, couldn't get the results done, to me it's ridiculous. I agree 100% with what Larry was saying. As an athletic commission, your job, first and foremost, should be to create a level playing field for the athletes, and they failed to do so. If I was Nick Diaz, I'd be fucking pissed off, and I'm sure he is, because basically the commission let him get in there with somebody that, you know, was on steroids or using performance-enhancing drugs, and, you know, granted, he did fail a test as well, but it's not the same situation, you know. What Anderson was doing, as far as competition goes, is a lot more serious than Nick Diaz being high out of his mind when he steps in the cage. I just think the whole thing, it's a little fishy to me.
And Tom, imagine if Anderson had seriously hurt Diaz in this fight. How do you come back from that? How? I mean, isn't that the worst PR disaster known to man for the UFC and for the Nevada State Athletic Commission? You actually tested the guy. His sample was actually at the lab on the 12th. No one followed up. No one supposedly got a result. And you let perhaps the best MMA fighter in the history of the sport, if not he's on the Mount Rushmore, you let him get in the cage on two performance-enhancing drugs and the other guy got a horrific injury? Yeah, good luck with that.
And you talked about, Larry, the commission had a lot to make on this. You know, a $5 million gate, I think they get about 6%. I think that's the number, right?
I don't know the exact number of what their percentage is.
Okay, I think it's 6%. So that's about
$300,000.
Now, Anderson made a base of $600,000. And Nick made a base of $300,000. They're going to get 30% of that. There's another $300,000. So this has been a gigantic windfall for the Athletic Commission. That's their whole budget right there.
And this is exactly why, if you go back to when George stepped away after the Hendricks fight, what did he say? I'm not coming back unless an independent third-party group that has no skin in the game. Whoever does the testing can't be in a position where they have to be in an ethical quandary and a financial quandary about whether to report the results or report them in a timely fashion. Because if you're doing the testing and by publicly outing whoever failed before a fight, you personally are going to lose money, that creates a financial problem for you. Whoever's doing the testing should care not at all about whether a fight takes place or doesn't take place. They should only care about the fairness of the fight and the safety of the fighters. And that means, hey, I don't care if John Jones fails. I don't care if Anderson Silva. I don't care if Brock Lesnar comes back and they have a $10 million gate. He failed. He can't fight. That, if it's not like that, and it's understandable why George said what he said now, if it's not like that, In the face of all this stuff and the John Jones cocaine test, and then supposedly, if you believe this, nobody told John Jones that he tested positive. I can't even say it with a straight face. Nobody told him he had cocaine in his system. Nobody talked to him about it. The athletic commission, Dana, the UF, nobody said a word until the fight was over. That doesn't sound like health and safety of the fighter first. So at the end of the day, it has to be a third party organization. There are several of them out there, and there is no reason except financial that the UFC would not embrace that. And if they don't, I don't think they can ever with a straight face look at anybody and say that they have a true concern for the health and safety of the fighters when they're not willing to put a testing program in place that ensures the greatest likelihood of the health and safety of their fighters.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, just to wrap it up here, I'd like to get both of your opinion on this. Let's go to the penalty phase of the trial, so to speak. I think Anderson will get 1 year. And I think, oddly enough, just for marijuana, I think Nick Diaz is going to get 2 years. So, Tom, what do you think is going to happen? And then, Larry, if you could jump in then.
Yeah, Brian, I agree with you on the penalty front, simply because Nick Diaz has tested positive in the past, and he outright said he wasn't going to smoke weed again, and then outright admitted that he started smoking it again as soon as he, as soon as he got home from making that statement. So, yeah, I think they're going to come down hard on him. Just to backtrack a little bit and correct you a little bit, Brian, Diaz made $500,000
for his performance
at UFC 183. So if you go off them taking 10%, they're actually going to make $50,000 off of just him. Now,
they're going to take 30 from him.
30. Okay, so they're going to take 30%. So they're looking at $150,000.
Wow.
If they go down that road, is my math correct? Yes, it is. So. Yeah, I think that you're looking at some pretty harsh penalties for those two guys. The biggest story, I wouldn't say that because the fighter safety thing is a major issue for me. But one of the bigger stories coming out of this to me is the tarnishment that it puts on Anderson Silva's past record. You can take a look at his career, and it's quite apparent when he made the jump up into the higher weight classes, he started performing better. And looking back now after this failed test, perhaps that is a direct result of him taking PEDs. I don't know whether it is or whether it isn't, but in my mind, as a fan, as a fighter, it has cast a gigantic shadow of doubt over his past performances as well. And I think he should be penalized majorly. He was just in the media talking about how John Jones is doing everything wrong. Well, apparently, the only thing John Jones was doing wrong is he's doing the wrong drugs, if you're Anderson Silva. So I hope they come down hard on him. I hope they take a bunch of his money. I hope that they give him a suspension. And I hope that his tests come back positive so that we don't look like idiots in a few weeks.
Well, there's one more test. Two more tests, right? January 19th and then the post-fight.
Well, they said the post-fight results were back, correct? Because that's how they nailed Diaz.
But I thought that was wrong. Only for drugs of abuse.
Yeah, that's true.
I could be wrong on that.
Well, when I say drugs, well, everything can be abused, but I mean like street drugs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, Larry, what do you think about penalties for the guys? And then speak to the legacy. Is Anderson Silva now the Barry Bonds of this sport, the greatest performer, but you know has this giant shadow over him?
I think on the penalties, I don't think they're going to go as heavy on Anderson. I think it'll be 9 months or 12 months, one or the other, because it's the first time that he's failed. I agree that they'll go heavier on Nick. How much they'll fine them, you know, they can increase the fine from there if they want to. So we'll see what they do with that. The legacy issue, this is the thing that keeps getting to me. Being around athletes a lot, if I'm in Anderson's camp and I'm sitting down at the table and we're discussing, let's say he's using the, if there was ever a fighter on Anderson's entire record that you would think you don't need to use anything to beat this guy, it's Nick Diaz. Like if I went into a lab and I was going to create the perfect fighter for Anderson to look amazing against, who had virtually no chance of beating him, it's Nick Diaz, a guy who doesn't wrestle, a guy who's not an 85er to begin with. He's a 70, and he's fought as low as 60 against Gomi. Anderson's fought as high as 205, and Nick's not going to be stronger than him. He's not going to try to take him down. So my point is,
he doesn't check kicks either.
No, and he doesn't throw many. Yeah. So like all he does basically is box and have great cardio. You don't need to be a whole lot stronger to contend with that. So that kind of brings me to, why would you use for Nick Diaz? This is like, oh, wow, I got caught using cocaine, but it's the first time I ever used it. What a coincidence. Well, this is the first time Anderson's been popped. But why Nick? Are you going to tell me honestly that the first time that you ever thought you needed to be stronger for a fight was Nick Diaz? It wasn't Chael Sonnen, a huge 85er with a power double. It wasn't Chris Weidman, a huge 85er who's a great wrestler and grappler. It wasn't the three times that you fought a 205. It was Nick. Like, that's not fathomable to me. And I think what happens, and Tom may be able to speak to this depending on who he's been around, athletes who get used to an aspect of their preparation – psychologically start to become reliant on that aspect of their preparation. So you ask an athlete who has used in the past, this is one of the reasons I think Vitor is going to get obliterated by Weidman. I thought he would have gotten beaten by Weidman anyway. I give him almost no chance because psychologically he's going to be walking in the cage for the first time in years where he hasn't been on testosterone. And a lot of people attribute, oh, see, physically he's not as strong, he's not as this. I think it's more mental. And mental is such a big part of fighting that if you're used to having this aid, it's hard to function without it mentally because that's part of your preparation. And I can't see an argument that Anderson Silva woke up sometime in the last year and said, holy crap, I'm going to fight Nick Diaz. I better get on some stuff.
That's a great point. Tom, do you have anything to finish up with?
No, I 100% agree with Larry on that front as well. You know, just personally from my own experience, I know, shit, if I go in the gym and I lose 10 pounds off a deadlift, I'm starting to get worried about what's going on in the training camp, you know?
Exactly.
So for somebody to, you know, all of a sudden, at the end of your career, when you're 40 years old, to start using steroids – and he looked realistically no different to me than he has in the past. Yeah, it just casts a major shadow of a doubt. And it's really unfortunate, you know. Personally for me, because I'm still active, it's demoralizing in a way to see this kind of stuff come out. Because a part of me, and maybe I'm just naive, but a part of me still would like to believe that there are guys out there who are doing the right thing. They're only doing cocaine and marijuana. They're not doing the PEDs and they're stepping in the cage as clean as can be. But it seems that as more time goes by, that's not the case. And, you know, it's sad.
And I agree with Tom. It is sad. This one, you know, you wake up, you turn on your computer, you bounce around on Twitter and the different sites, you see what's going on. And like when I open the, like how many times have we all done that and seen so-and-so tested positive, so-and-so tested positive. Okay, fine. This one felt different, man. I mean, this one I'll say like felt a little more like a kick in the gut because Anderson has fought a who's who of guys who have been on stuff. And you kind of looked at him like he might be the guy who's proving that technique and talent at the end of the day beats everything. And I think for him to fail, it definitely, I think, cuts at the heart of MMA more than the failures we've had in the past. So it's sad, but it is what it is, and we're not here to pretend that we live in Disneyland and everything is the way we want it to be. So if that second test comes back, I think his legacy, unfortunately, is tarnished, and I don't know how people will perceive him when they look back at that illustrious career going forward.
Yeah, and Larry, I just want to thank you for coming on. You gave a perspective that I really don't think anybody in MMA media would have the know-how to even talk about. You know,
thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, their extent of it is kind of like mine. You know, Wikipedia and Google. That's about it. And
some don't even go that far, Brian. Okay,
yeah.
Let's be honest.
Right.
Some of the stuff that floats around out there, I almost want to direct messages and say, "Hey, you know, there's this Google thing. If you ever want to check that out, it'd be a great idea."
Yeah. So thanks for bringing that unique perspective, and tell people how they can listen to your podcast. Excellent show. I was listening to it. Right around UFC 100, so it was 09.
Yep.
It's been around, or even before that. And how can they get at you on Twitter?
Thanks, man. On Twitter, it's Larry Pepe, real simple. Last four letters are P-E-P-E. And the podcast they can get at ProMMARadio.com, iTunes. And if there's any veterans, we are the MMA show for the American Forces Network. So you can get us on The Voice, which is their largest broadcast channel. And it's on Saturdays at 5 p.m. Pacific.
Great. Really appreciate it, Larry. We'll talk soon, man.
Pleasure's mine. Thanks a lot, guys.
Take care.
Thank you.